Well, we'll convene the conference committee on the energy policy bill, which is, I think, set at file 550. Is that correct? And we'll start out. We apologize for the space. Every conference committee, every major conference committee in the legislature has space reserved right now. We could go over to the House, but they want us to be close because both the House and Senate will be going under call a lot during the next few days. So we will probably be changing our space and moving around for our conference committee. And hopefully we'll find some larger space at some point. So bear with us. We're going to start by walking through the side-by-side just to familiarize ourselves with the various provisions. And so I'm going to ask Mr. Fuller to start.
Madam Chair, Mr. Eloff and I will share it. And the first language appears on page one is House language for a few pages. So I'll defer to Mr. Eloff.
Thank you, Mr. Fuller. Section one is from a civil sponsored by Representative Knuth. It specifies that as the 10-year period for wind projects receiving REPI payments concludes, that additional monies can be used specifically for hydroelectric facilities. And it also specifies that if those funds, and also for on-farm biogas recovery facilities, and specifies that if those funds allocated in year 2010 are insufficient, an additional $500,000 of additional funds from the renewable development account can be allocated to make up the difference. Section 3 on page R2 funds the University of Minnesota's Initiative for Renewable Energy and the Environment at $5 million beginning in July 1, 2011. Also from the renewable development account, and specifies that at least 15% of those funds must be for projects that are conducted at a rural campus or experiment station. Turning to R3, at the top of the page, it also specifies that beginning in 2011 and each year after that, the director of IRE report to the legislature on the activities that those funds have been used for. On page R3, section 3 is a provision that I believe Representative Bly brought. Paragraph A, increases the amount of award for appraisal fees under eminent domain proceeding that may be awarded from $500 to $1,500. And paragraph B exempts a public service corporation use of eminent domain for a high voltage transmission line. And it exempts that use from paragraph A, which itself is a list of exemptions from the eminent domain statute. And section 4 beneath that, still on page R3, specifies that whereas current law requires an easement acquired by condemnation, if it's not used for the purposes for which it was acquired, there's a process by which the owner can apply to the court for discharging that easement. And the current law says that section does not apply to easements acquired by a public service corporation. This language would exclude, would say that exclusion applies to other projects, but not for easements for high voltage transmission line. That was adopted on the House floor. And I'll turn this over to Mr. Fuller for the Senate language on page R3.
Section 1 and 2 are PUC proposals having to do with recording of proceedings before the PUC. Section 1 authorizes audio electronic recording. Section 2 authorizes the services of a court reporter. As I recall, these were PUC proposals, and the use of court reporters is also supported by the regulated utilities, was testified. Section 3 has to do with the ability of existing law where the PUC can suspend a rate increase while it does the general rate case. This allows an extension of time for up to, if you turn to page R4. I don't see the time there. on top of R5, you'll see that they can extend it for up to 90 days if there's an additional pending general rate case.
Yeah, I think that would be good.
Section 4. Amends the general rate law and allows an incentive plan for energy conservation improvements. The PUC brought this forward, and it provides that they can adopt any mechanism that satisfies the criteria of this subdivision. Section 5 is another PUC transmission cost adjustment. This amends a current law that allows for cost recovery of certain transmission costs. And the amendment is simply provides on 4.6, puts the word or in there. It's a technical correction because there's a series of ways you can have transmission projects approved, and it needed a conjunctive or disjunctive or. Section 6 on R7 is a similar provision to the House. It has to do, but it's different in some ways, with the ability of the utility serving the central corridor, the light rail transit from St. Paul to Minneapolis, to do more than the basics when they replace the infrastructure. They have to get the approval of the PUC. And the major difference between the two is that cost recovery is not permitted for these investments under the Senate provision. It was brought in by the utilities. Bob, would you like to talk about your section?
First, I'd like to ask you to jump back to page R6, the House language. Paragraph at the top of the page is not present in the Senate language. It's a provision that was sponsored by Representative Kalin, and it asked the commission to provide utilities with an incentive that makes effective implementation of cost-effective conservation the most profitable resource choice for public utilities. And let's skip to page R9, back with the House language. I'm sorry. Bottom of page R8, section 7. This is an amendment that was added on the House floor, which requires that qualifying owners of seabed projects must certify to the Commissioner of Commerce each year that the qualifying owner is still in compliance with the requirements of the seabed section. And at the top of page 9, section 8 was also a floor amendment added that essentially requires the same thing but refers specifically to certification of the qualifying owners in compliance with the requirements of a certain subdivision that pertain to Minnesota residency. Continuing on page R9, section 9, standardized seabed contract is a provision that was brought by Representative Falk, which requires the Public Utilities Commission to institute a proceeding to standardize contract provisions in for seabed projects, both those below and those greater than 5 megawatts. There's currently a provision in law that requires standardized contracts for seabed projects that are below 2 megawatts. At the bottom of page R9 and continuing in R10, there is another provision of Representative Falk's that requires that before the end of 2010, electric utilities in the state that are subject to the renewable energy standard provision purchase or contract to purchase in total 200 megawatts statewide of small projects that are below 5 megawatts. And the utilities must purchase in proportion to their sales as a proportion of total state sales. Can we jump over to Mr. Fuller? Page R10.
Section 7 amends the cost recovery for the renewable facilities. There was a scope that wasn't quite complete, so they had to add a class of facilities that wasn't covered that would meet the RES that would be eligible for cost recovery. That's the language on 6.24 and 6.28. They just don't go through the certificate of need process. And then on page R11, there's new language on 7.9 clarifying what's eligible for cost recovery, which is advanced research and understanding of how storage devices may improve renewable energy projects. You want to talk about the difference, Bob? We both have similar provisions.
Very little, just some language differences
yeah,
there.
A little bit, quite similar. On, back on R11, Section 8 is the green rate option. A few years ago, where that's a law, a current law, that allows consumers to ask or to select an option for a rate that they can pay the difference between the basic rate would have been and the rate with a renewable mix in it. That was scheduled for repeal, and it's being reinstated. The repealer is later repealed later on. So that restores that rate option to a consumer.
One difference in the House language versus the Senate in this provision is at the very bottom of the page on R11, which speaks to the rate that may be charged for green pricing. And I guess I'd describe the difference as, whereas when the green pricing program was first begun in 2001, their utilities had generally very little renewable generation. So the price that was asked, the customers who selected that option were asked to pay, was, as is stated in the Senate language, the difference between the cost of buying the renewables versus the same amount of non-renewable energy. The House language, I think, updates this to reflect the fact that utilities now have different proportions of non-renewable energy, and the price needs to reflect the price that's charged to customers who select this option needs to reflect that change. Turning to R12, in the middle of the page is a change to the renewable energy standard. Change is actually on page R13. With respect to Xcel Energy, which is required to have 30% of its generation by 2020 coming from renewable sources, the House language is House language says at least 25% of that must be generated by solar. The Senate has the same provision, but says that solar can be no more than 1% of that 30%. Well, yes, wind or solar can yes. Thank you. Member Representative Hilty for pointing that. At the bottom of that page, R13, are provisions which are essentially the same with some slight language changes. The House provision was sponsored by Representative Kula Jackson, which gives the Public Utilities Commission authority to issue refunds in cases where they've determined that a rate has been charged in violation of Chapter 216B. Turning to R14, energy saving goals. The House language and the Senate language both give utilities the option of carrying forward energy savings in excess of the 1.5% energy goal required each year, carrying those forward for the succeeding 3 years. But the Senate also says that infrastructure projects can be carried forward for 5 years, and that's a provision that the House language does not contain. Turning to page R15, at the bottom is language in the House version that allows up to 5% of the utilities' conservation improvement spending to be used for rebates to homeowners who install a solar thermal project or a geothermal project or a heating unit that burns specific kinds of biomass. The rebate would be the lesser of 25% of the purchase price and installation costs, or $500, which whichever is less. And on R16, I'll turn it back to Mr. Fuller.
Madam Chair, this is Section 12 and R16 is the solar SIP provision. Under the SIP law, you can invest some of the money in generation under the Section 216B.2411. This provides that an incentive can be granted to the utilities in their rates for this solar SIP. And I would note that a lot of these earlier provisions that are similar, they have the same advocates in both houses, and some of it depends on how it was fine-tuned in that entity. So they are, the proposals were brought forward in many cases by the same folks. Bob?
On the bottom of page R16, or section 17, which allows natural gas utilities to include in their conservation improvement plan purchases biomethane, which is produced from anaerobic digestion of biomass, and allows utilities that do that to use up to 5% of their SIF spending to purchase the biomethane. On R17, in the middle of the page, is language amending the Sustainable Building 2030 program. The changes are actually on page R18 and R19. Both the House and the Senate have the same change on R19, which essentially says that a utility design assistance program must consider the strategic planting of trees and shrubs around buildings as energy conservation strategy for a project. What's different in the House language is on page R18 in the middle of the page there, which is essentially a clarification of the intent of the language that specifies that the Center for Sustainable Building Research, which is getting the bulk of the funds under this program, is also eligible to carry out substantive programmatic activities under this subdivision, not only to do administrative tasks. And that brings us to page R19. Actually, the change language in that section is on at the top of page R20, which is specifying that utilities can exceed the current 5% cap on the amount of SIF money that utilities can spend on solar projects. And this language essentially allows utilities to request authority from the Commissioner of Commerce, I guess, to exceed that limit. Senate language also allows this exceeding 5%, but also says no more than 10%, which is a provision that's not in the House language. Otherwise, there's some slight differences in language there. On page R20, the actual changes are on page R21. Change the definition of a qualifying solar electric project. Both the House and Senate versions add energy storage equipment to that definition, although we do so in different language. And at the bottom of R21 is the change is actually on R23. Is a change to the contract for the Laurentian Energy Project and XL Energy, which sets a ceiling price and instructs them to negotiate and amend their power purchase agreement, essentially, which brings us to page R23, and I'll hand that over to John.
R23, section 17. On 17.27, repeals a current law that prohibits the Public Utilities Commission from issuing a certificate of need for the construction of a new nuclear-powered electric generating plant. Section 18 and Section 19 correspond with some House provisions. These are exemptions to the certificate of need law for certain wind facilities. It was brought to us by, I think, the Department of Commerce. And again, the differences may just reflect the timing of receiving those, although I think there's a different approach. I think the Senate thought that the language that and stricken on page R24, lines 18.24 to 30, might be duplicative of the language in subdivision 9. So the ascertaining of whether or not that's true will determine which provision the committee decides to take. Bob?
Yeah, the House language at the bottom of page R24 essentially loosened the conditions under which project would be exempt from going through the certificate of need process compared with current language. On page R25, this is the subdivision 9 that Mr. Fuller was referring to. In the House, this was brought by Representative Magnus, I believe. And there are very different things going on. You can see on line 19.3 in the Senate version, when making this determination, the Commission must consider that as well as an A in the House language on line 2016. So the Senate is essentially saying that the Commission must consider all six provisions on the Senate side. The House essentially leaves the Commission may consider those same six provisions. And at the bottom of page R25 is some House language that is not in the Senate version of the bill, which changes the experience required of the reliability administrator in the Department of Commerce, because we've heard that the existing requirements were so stringent given the pay levels that the state can pay, that it's a major reason why there's been no one hired to do that job for a couple of years. Page R26, I'll turn over to you, John.
The Senate language there is a proposal to start a dialogue between the regulators and the legislature with respect to transmission infrastructure needs. It's somewhat parallel to a greenhouse gas reporting provision that was adopted last year. It proved quite helpful to have the regulators come in and explain what they were doing. That's a thought. It's very low-key, no special research. Just tell the legislature what, in the normal course of their duties and regulating utilities, they think is necessary with respect to transmission.
At the top of page R27 is a provision in the House that was brought by Representative Thiessen, which says that in the annual report that the Pollution Control Agency does with respect to recommending greenhouse gas reduction strategies to the legislature, that it include strategies that would increase the use of solar energy and the combustion of biomass if they determine that such policies are appropriate.
Section 21 on the Senate side is simply a reviser's request to correct an absolute rule reference with a statutory reference concerning the cold weather rule. It's a technical change.
Page R28 is the first of several sections dealing with permitting of wind energy conversion systems that was brought in the House by Representative Falk. Section 26, the top of the page on the renewable development count, is a companion piece to the first section in the House language of this bill regarding specifying that hydroelectric facilities are eligible to receive RECI payments. But beginning with section 27 and 28 change the definition of large and small wind energy conversion systems. Under this change, anything below 25,000 or 25 megawatts is considered small. And on page R29, at the top of the page, there's a paragraph stricken that's current language that allowed, if developers so wished, to anything up to 25 megawatts could be considered small, and that option sunsets as of July 1st, 2009, as you can see on line 22.30. In a sense, what this bill is doing is making that temporary election to be considered small permanent. In the middle of the page, section 30 essentially restores that language to its current meaning and incorporates the change in definitions made above. The meat of this language is on page R30, which specifies that county boards can, if they so elect, issue site permits. Now, for any project of 25 megawatts or less. Page, it also specifies that general permit standards, which are developed by the Public Utilities Commission, may apply to permits issued by counties. while they must apply to permits issued by the commission. And
it further states at the end of that paragraph, the permit standards established by the county under this section supersede general permit standards that are established by the commission. Right above that is also language that specifies setback standards for building systems that are different from what they are now. R30, John?
Section 22 on R30 is a direction to the Legislative Energy Commission to look at the SIP program, which we've been told under SIP utilities have about $100 million a year current obligation to spend. And so they can, the commission can look at any aspect, but particularly at the aspect of awarding credit for educational activities, the use of third parties to develop or implement conservation plans, and if you turn the page over, a mechanism so that utilities and associations can invest in plans statewide if that produces the best conservation results. These are all study issues for the Legislative Energy Commission. Again, on Section 23, it gives the asks the Legislative Energy Commission or requires them to look at appliance standards. As you can see, the criteria are they should look at the effect of the standard on the appliance market, the effect of the standard on consumer costs of purchasing, and technical ability to comply with the standard currently and in the future, and energy savings. So they're just to look at the area and make recommendations. This is not adopting any standards. Section 24, I'm not familiar if the House has much activity. Early in the session, the Senate had a number of hearings on a proposal to adopt low-carbon fuel standards for transportation fuel for motor vehicles, and it was decided that further study might be or was required, and that's just asked for that study. Section 25 was brought in by a gas utility, and it simply authorizes the Commissioner of Commerce has to approve SIP plans, and this authorizes the commission, doesn't require the commissioner, but authorizes to approve an energy conservation improvement plan that meets certain requirements. As you can see on the top of page 32, the commissioner is still free to order the utility or to require a plan that would meet the goals if those were attainable. The House has very similar language. Again, it was brought in by the same proponents. Did you want to talk about that at all, Bob? Or?
I would just say the House language is maybe a little bit more prescriptive.
Yeah. Section 26 is another requirement for the Legislative Energy Commission to look at an issue. This was an MCAG issue, the Greenhouse Gas Group, Advisory Group, and the issue is what sort of energy disclosure should be made to buyers or renters of real property, and that turned out to be, there was a bill introduced, turned out to be a fairly complex issue, and so it was thought it was better to have a comprehensive look at it to see if the, any legislation should be enacted or proposed. Section on R33, you can see that as part of the study, there should be a comprehensive of the energy disclosure, a comprehensive stakeholder group, because there are a number of very interested parties in the real estate transaction industry. Section 27 was provoked by the knowledge that there are a lot of provisions in the statute that, well, first of all, we have general rate regulated investor-owned utilities, and they go through a general rate case to get recovery of their costs. But many statutes, I forget, it was 20 or 21, allow cost recovery, and the charges that dilutes the general rate case. And so we thought we should have a study that looked at that issue and see if there was a better way to go about allowing cost recovery for utilities and rate regulation. And Public Utilities Commission is going to do that in consultation with the Office of Energy Security. And the Public Utilities Commission was interested in this issue. Section 28, under LIHEAP, there are requirements that are imposed on the utilities with respect to cold weather rules, just with respect to the cold weather rule, and we have for heating fuels. And there is a class of heating fuels called the delivered fuel, propane and fuel oil, that some advocates feel need some sort of regulation light in this area. And this is a reporting requirement to find out, get information to see if there is any reason to regulate them and what's going on out there in the delivered fuel area. You can see it's quite extensive. A lot of this is already being reported, is our understanding. It was part of a larger package that was brought forward by Senator Rosen, and this is the remnants of it.
Beginning on the bottom of page R34 and continuing on the top of R35 is a provision brought by Representative Bruce Avina, which would give authority to the Mountain Iron Economic Development Authority to form or become a member of a limited liability company in order to do a seabed project. It also allows the authority to acquire a leasehold interest in property outside its corporate boundaries for purposes of that project. Section 33 in the middle of the page requires a report from the cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul to the Legislative Energy Commission, essentially looking at barriers that exist to slow down the increase in solar installations and how those barriers can be overcome. That reports the first part of it is due in October 2009, the second part in October 2010. And just finishing up on page R6, section 35,
is appropriation to the clean energy resource teams, which are regional bodies that have been in existence for several years now. Do you want to talk about that revisor's instruction on 29, John?
I really do.
Okay.
That instruction on section 29 has to do with the fact that it's obsolete cold weather rule references. They've been replaced by statutory references or rule references. And the repealer on both sides, which I think is our only identical language. I'm not sure. Is that
really we're doing a little bit better than that.
has to do with the repeal of the sunset of the green pricing program, which is amended in another section of the bill.
Okay. So that brings us to the end of our side-by-side walkthrough. Are there questions or comments or anybody need any further clarification on any of this at this time? No? Okay. I think what... Do you know if any of the bodies are back in? Okay. I think that... Do you know if we're back in session?
Finances meeting, I don't know whenever they're finished.
Let's take a brief recess at this time. Let's say half an hour. And what I'd like to do is try to... look at what is same or similar and see if we can accept language that is same or similar and weed out most of that at this point and then move on to some of the more difficult legislation that might require, further testimony or further discussion anyways. So we'll take a recess for one half hour and resume back in here at 10 to 5 then. 10 to 6, I guess.
That's just for being
in there. Sorry, your leftovers. It's a little far. You could have a retreat up.
God, it is. God, this is the intro. Yeah, that was just a big one.